For the week of July 29th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 418, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How are you, Sperling?
I'm doing okay. How about yourself? I mean, it's hot as hell here in Los Angeles.
Record high temperatures have been set or matched in 118 different locations around the world in July.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
118. Global warming, climate change, real thing. But now that brings us to the law of the jungle, Sperling. You cannot attack another animal when we're at the water hole. That is a sacred space. You do not attack other animals. No fighting, no arguing. We all need water, and therefore we cannot fight when we're at the water hole. There is a truce when you're at the water. You know that, right?
Can I ask you something, Michael?
Yes.
And I mean this in all sincerity. Have you been hit on the head recently by a large object?
No, but I have read The Jungle Book by Rudyard Kipling, which is a book I love. I think Rudyard Kipling's a great writer. I can debate his colonialism and racism with you. He certainly was prejudiced.
Oh, but, I know exactly what you're talking about now.
Right. So, yes, The Jungle Book, great novel. It's never been adapted well into film, not once. The Jungle Book animated version on Disney has some great songs, but it doesn't really capture what's great about those collections of stories. Certainly the last one didn't by Jon Favreau, but I'm looking forward to Mowgli, the Andy Serkis version, which Warner Brothers is releasing in the... Wait, what?
Yeah, no, they're not releasing it. First of all, you stand in the minority of what everybody thought about Jon Favreau's version.
No, I don't. That didn't get good reviews. It was popular, but it was not a critically acclaimed adaptation by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, and won some Academy Awards.
For special effects. It was not on best of the year list for most people.
No, it's not a good movie.
Well, that's what we mean, a good, well-reviewed film. It wasn't on most people's best of the year. It was great special effects, I grant you that. Not a great film, but even if it was, it did not capture the tone and message of the book at all. But there's another chance. Maybe Andy Serkis did it.
Well, first of all, the Jon Favreau version did get good reviews, but let's put that to the side for right now, because when that movie was being made back in the 2012-2014 timeframe, Warner Brothers said, we're going to make a Rudyard Kipling Jungle Book movie too.
And I thought they announced theirs first. They announced theirs first. Two projects went on. Warner Brothers delayed theirs so they would not, you know, butt up against each other, which is a smart thing to do. Unfortunately for them, the Jon Favreau version was a huge box office success. Not a critical success, but a box office
95% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That, haven't we learned on this show, that's no way to judge a movie? That means 95% of the people might have said, it's okay. That's all that tells you. That tells you nothing. If you listen to this show, you would know that. You should listen to Showbiz Sandbox sometime.
Yeah, but when you actually read the reviews, they're good.
Oh my God. Warner Brothers dumped the movie. That's all we wanted to say. Warner Brothers dumped the film. They handed it off to Netflix for an undisclosed price. Instead of bringing it to the theaters and seeing what happened, they've seen the movie, and now they've dumped it onto Netflix.
Well, that means one thing is certain. And that is, we'll never know how many people watched it because Netflix doesn't report it. And it won't have to be compared to the Disney version, the 2016 Disney version, which made $966 million at the box office, because it won't have any box office.
That's right. Mowgli wasn't going to come close to that, probably. But it's funny you should mention Netflix and not having ratings and not reporting how many people watch what, when, where, why, and how. We do have Nielsen and other people trying to figure that out. And in fact, my brother is a Nielsen diary person. He did one for TV, and now they've sent him a diary to cover what he listens to for a week of radio listening to, which he does a lot of. So he's in his car a lot, and he listens to the radio a lot, mostly sports stations, and they sent him a diary. So he's supposed to keep track all day, every day of what he listens to. And I have to admit, I was a little shocked. They still send out paper diaries.
Yeah, I know. Well, especially for the radio, yes.
I mean, you would think they'd have, or for TV, you'd think they'd have an app now. You know, you would think they would say, put in your zip code, and then they'd say, all right, here are the 20 or 30 popular stations in your zip code. Click on your favorites. You can always add another one in, but click on your favorites. And then with 9 a.m., you press a button and say, oh, they would already know what show you're listening to. Were you listening to Joe and Tom in the morning? Click, yeah, you know? I mean, you would think they would make it as easy as possible for you to track what you're listening to and when.
Well, just audio thumbprinting. They could say, oh, we know exactly what show you're listening to and what station you're on and where your location. And they know all of that through a phone app.
Every 15 minutes, at least, every radio station announces loudly who they are. You would think they'd say, got the radio on, turn on the app. Exactly, like Shazam. And they course they would know the songs, whatever, but every 15 minutes they would know what station you're on. So while they wouldn't know second to second, they could just track what you're listening to every 15 minute increment, and there'd be no question about what you were listening to. The idea that they're still having people take a pen and paper and fill out a, that is ridiculous. Nielsen, for the love of God, get on the ball. And Sperling, you get on the ball, because I want you to write down in your diary right now, next week, no show. Why? It's my fault, said Sperling.
It is my fault, said me.
That's right. Sperling's going to be out of town. He's going to be traveling. And so we won't have a show next week. I, of course, will sit at home and talk to the listeners, but they won't hear me because my microphone won't be plugged in.
Talk louder.
We'll talk louder. So next week, we don't know what the show would have been, but this week we do.
That's right. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, the tension is mounting. Falling stock prices, rising scandals, Netflix snagging a troubled movie and a hot TV talent, but still no bidding war for podcasts. Darn it. In China news, that's all I have to say. In China news. Doesn't matter what comes after that.
There's always more news.
Yeah. Most theme parks may be losing money, okay? But that isn't stopping more of them from opening up in China. Hello, Nickelodeon. Meanwhile, MoviePass. Again, that's all I need to say. But MoviePass is at a crossroads or a cliff. We won't know for a few days or weeks, but the subscription film company had a truly chaotic week. Apparently, they ran out of money, borrowed $5 million to keep the lights on, changed their rules again, and decided pretty much no one gets to see Mission Impossible for free. Stop complaining, they begged their members. We're changing the movie business, so just stick with us. By the way, if MoviePass is on a cliff and they can hire Tom Cruise, they should, because I hear he's pretty good at, you know, climbing cliffs, especially
they cannot afford Tom Cruise.
That's true, actually. But if they could get him, he can climb cliffs without ropes. In Book Filter news, we've got one memoir ready for its close-up and a terrific mystery that still hasn't been optioned. Somebody call 40 Acres and a Mule pronto. During sexual misconduct, Ronan Farrow strikes again with a takedown of Les Moonves, he of CBS fame, not to mention the stock of CBS. On Inside Baseball, we'll look more closely at volatile stocks like CBS, Spotify, and Facebook, and what it means for the business. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, You Are Listeners, and the number one movie around the world. It was a close one, but the number one movie is indeed Mission Impossible Fallout. $153 million on its opening four-day weekend, because most movies now open on a Thursday night. It made a lot of money. It had its biggest opening weekend, if you include that Thursday night figure, biggest opening weekend of all time in North America, its biggest worldwide opening. It made $12 million from IMAX. Isn't that exciting? And the fact that they mentioned IMAX reminds me of how little anyone ever mentions 3D. It's just not mentioned anymore. Isn't that telling? But anyway, Fallout is off to a great start, $150 million worldwide. The last two movies made $700 million when all was said and done. They certainly hope to get there with this one.
Well, it did all of that, first of all, without MoviePass. We'll get to that in a moment. But secondly, I never saw, and I'm going to admit this, I never saw Rogue Nation, Mission Impossible 5. Okay, so you'd think that before I go see Mission Impossible Fallout, aka Mission Impossible 6, I should probably see it. Okay, in fact, many critics mentioned, hey, this one actually, you do need to see the one before it. So I wanted to go see it. So is it on Netflix? No. Is it on Amazon? No. Is it on HBO Go? No. Is it on any streaming service? Yeah, DirecTV if you can get it. And maybe one other service. So you pretty much had to buy it or rent it.
Well, that's the problem. Well, if you could rent it for what, $4, $3?
Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah.
So that's really not too bad. But that is one of the problems of the world today. There are so many streaming services. So many things are available on so many different places. You don't know what is where, when. It's really hard just to figure out what is where. And if you could create a portal to do that, you would be rich.
Actually, you could actually talk to the guy who has created a portal like that. It's called gowatchit.com.
Yeah, but it doesn't have everything.
It's got a lot.
Yeah, I've tried it. Doesn't work. But anyway, the funny thing about the Mission Impossible movies is they keep coming quicker and quicker. Between 2 and 3, there was a 6-year gap. Then 3 and 4, a 5-year gap. Then a 4-year gap. Now a 3-year gap between number 5 and 6, which means, I guess, Mission Impossible 7 will be out in 2020.
Or next week.
That's right. Or next week. We didn't have to wait long for Hello, Mr. Billionaire. It's not a sequel, but it is from the same team in China that created Goodbye, My Loser. It sounds sort of similar, but
I think these names are translated poorly.
I don't think so. Hello, Mr. Billionaire had a huge opening weekend in China, $130 million in the Middle Kingdom. It's a $22 million comedy, so when it opens to $130 million, you've had a really, really good weekend. I mean, to put it in perspective, Mission Impossible costs $180 million. So this movie damn near beat it in just one territory, and it only cost $22 million to make. It's a comedy about a guy who inherits $4 billion. So he will be Mr. Billionaire, but there's a catch. He has to spend $150 million in 30 days and have nothing to show for it when the month is over. And he can't explain to anyone what the heck is going on and where he got this money and why he's trying to spend it so fast.
Hold on. Say that again slowly, because I'm making notes for my pitch meeting tomorrow at the studios.
Pitch meeting is remake Hey Mr. Billionaire. That's all you need to know.
Exactly. That sounds like a good movie.
Anyway, it stars Cheng Xian, and it was co-written and directed by the same team that made Goodbye, My Loser, another film. That movie made $230 million worldwide. This one clearly is being treated like a sequel by a lot of fans. It's off to a huge, huge start. At number three around the world is the Adam Sandler animated flick Hotel Transylvania 3, $43 million on the weekend, $285 million worldwide. And number four is another opening in China and other territories, including North America. It's the fourth film in a series, Detective D, The Four Heavenly Kings. It's a period fantasy thriller. This is sort of the young Detective D. So we had a movie about Detective D and then another one. And now we've had two prequels set when he's just a younger guy starting out in the detectiving business. It made $43 million on its opening weekend. That was a really good start. People were happy. I don't know the budget, though the budget on the first one was about $20 million. I'm assuming the fourth one is more expensive, but it was certainly overshadowed by, hey, Mr. Billionaire. At number five is Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, $41 million on the weekend, $167 million worldwide. And what a relief that is. Finally, a movie that acts like a sequel. In the old days, if you made a movie and then you made a completely unnecessary sequel, it made about a half or a third of what the original made. And the studio said, we got lucky. You know, that's exactly what happened with Mamma Mia. The original made an unbelievable $600 million worldwide. They made a thoroughly unnecessary sequel with lesser ABBA songs, and people are reacting appropriately. They're like, yeah, okay, I'll go see it, maybe.
Yeah, you know, I can tell you that this week, the 18 to 30 demo, attendance was down by about 50 to 60%. But
compared to 1 year earlier?
Compared to a similar weekend the same year. Yeah, one year
earlier. Yeah, but it would depend what movie's opening.
Well, exactly. Now, this weekend, 50 plus was up, seeing mostly what, you know.
Mission Impossible.
And, well, men was Mission Impossible, and women was Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
So Mission Impossible actually did much better with women. They upped the quotient of women who were seeing the movie, so they're very happy about that. They got more women going to the movie this time than with the opening weekend of Part 5.
Oh, that's cool.
Anyway, families on the whole went to see Incredibles 2, another $30 million on the weekend. It's this close to $1 billion. That will be the third Pixar film to hit the $1 billion mark, and they were all sequels. Toy Story 3, Finding Dory, and now The Incredibles 2.
By the way, if you would like to watch Goodbye, Mr. Loser, okay, you can do so on Amazon Prime in the United States. And I learned that from GoWatchIt.com.
GoWatchIt.com. There will be no sequel, however, to Skyscraper, the Dwayne Johnson flick, $23 million on the weekend. So it's still chugging along, but it's losing steam. It's pretty much done in China. It will probably top out $100 million in that country. Worldwide, Skyscraper has made $256 million. China is by far its best territory, but it's not going to triple its budget. It won't be a flop or a disaster, but it's not going to be a big success like so many Dwayne Johnson films have proven to be. Ant-Man and the Wasp is slowing down a bit. That made another $20 million on this weekend. It's at $400 million worldwide. Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, well past the $1 billion mark, $1.2 billion. The Equalizer 2, I must have been high last weekend because I think I slipped and said, looks like they've got a franchise. I don't know why I would have said that. It cost $60 million to make. It's at $70 million worldwide. It's true, it's only in 12 territories, but I don't think we're going to get anywhere near $180 million. This will probably be the end of the road for The Equalizer, given poor reviews and a little less box office than the first one.
And the fact that Denzel Washington, this is his first sequel. So
it is his, well, it's designed to be a film with sequels. It was a TV show, and now it's a movie. So if it had done well and gotten good reviews, maybe there would have been a third one.
Right. Speaking of TV shows that are now movies.
I mean, yeah, you know, I really wish he'd made a sequel to Devil in a Blue Dress. He was a great Easy Rollins. That was a great movie. My God, there should have been sequels to that. It was a great, great flick. He really delivered. It was a great character. And, you know, Easy Rollins ages. I wish to God they could make more of those movies because, you know, he really embodied that role. And he's not too old to play Easy Rollins later in his career. But yes, I did use MoviePass this weekend. I was able to go to one screening on Friday or Saturday morning, the 11 a.m. screening of Teen Titans Go to the Movies. That was the only movie available without a surcharge. I wanted to see it, and I went. $11 million on its opening weekend. Thank you, MoviePass. It only cost $10 million to make, so it's going to be just fine when all is said and done. It's pretty clever. Not as quite as good as I was hoping. It's a clever, you know, jokey little film, but I really love the kicker. The last joke before the credits rolled, I really enjoyed. If you're a parent and you went, you're probably laughing too.
Don't at give it away. Spoiler alert.
I won't. I'm not talking about the joke in the credits because they do have a credit joke. I'm talking about right towards the end of the movie.
Okay.
At number 12 is The First Purge. It's at $111 million. And when it passes $119 million, it will, of course, be the highest grossing Purge film yet. Each one has made more money than the one before that may end now that they're launching Purge, the TV series. At number 13 is a Korean film. I'm not saying this right, Alang. I tried to look up the pronunciation of this, but I couldn't find it anywhere. So it's Alang, The Wolf Brigade. It's a $17 million movie. It opened up to $5 million, so that's not great. It's a Korean spinoff of a Japanese film series set in the near future. There were two live-action Japanese films, then the third one was done in animation, and now they've done a spinoff in Korean that is back to live-action. In this case, it's set in the near future, sort of a sci-fi movie, and it takes place in a world where the Korea is reuniting. They're going to form one government for North Korea and South Korea, and a lot of people are upset on both sides of the border, and this new police force known as the Wolf Brigade has been created to quell the uprising. So what an interesting concept for Korea. I'm baffled by that. The idea of this being a movie project. So I'd love to get some reaction from the Korean fans. If you've seen this movie and you can talk to us about how it relates culturally to what the attitudes are in Korea, I'd love to hear from you.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter at ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox.
Back to the box office. At number 14, the Chinese dark comedy Dying to Survive is finally slowing down in that country. It's at $450 million, so no need to make any more money. They've made a ton. At number 15, we have a one-night performance, sort of like a Met Live, except in this case, it's not the Metropolitan Opera, but the violinist André Rieu, who is sort of a, you know, like a river dance for Strauss waltzes. He tours all over the world with an elaborate stage show and a full big orchestra playing waltzes. It's, you know, for people who don't like classical music, you'll love André Rieu.
It's kind of like Hooked on Classics.
It is indeed. And his 2018 Maastricht concert, it's sort of an annual event. Every year it pops up on theater screens. It grossed $3.9 million worldwide. Believe me, that's a pittance compared to what he makes on tour. He's in the U.S. right now. I think he's in Milwaukee this week. And at some years, he's been the highest grossing male artist in concert tours worldwide. So he makes a lot of money. And number six is the film Sperling saw using MoviePass, Ocean's 8. That's at $270 million worldwide. Then right below that, we have another Korean film. It's a kiddie animated flick. It's called Mysterious Apartment, Golden Goblin, and The Secret Cave. $1.8 million on its opening weekend, so it looks like a low-budget animated film, and we have to hope it's a very low-budget animated film. Looking for anything else new? I see Sorry to Bother You is still doing well in North America, but as I thought, once I saw the movie, it is starting to tap out. It sort of hit its peak level, starting to slow down. It made another $1.4 million this weekend. It's at $13 million and counting, so it's done just great. But this is not a movie I think that's going to have Oscar potential, given the type of movie it is. And right below that is a isn't it a movie that MoviePass has a piece of, Blindspotting, or they're just
advertising for it? They're just,
oh, okay. So this movie was all over MoviePass. I felt like they owned it because they talked about it so much. It's called Blindspotting. It's a comic drama about a guy on probation trying to get through his final 3 days without getting in trouble, but his jerk off of a friend is not helping things. And it was co-written, co-produced, and starring David Diggs of Hamilton. It was the opening night film at Sundance. It got picked up, and now it's had a pretty good opening weekend. $1.8 million on its opening weekend.
And Eighth Grade by Bo Burnham, still doing well.
That's had a good expansion. It expanded to about 300 screens and is doing quite well. Good word of mouth, still building. That's at $3 million and counting. And the documentary film, there are two documentary films in the top 15, including Three Identical Strangers, $6.7 million. Now, the Mr. Rogers documentary has grossed $20 million, which is amazing. You know what? $6 million is amazing, too. That's a lot of money for a documentary film.
You know, this weekend when I went to the theater, I was standing in line outside the box office, and a couple walked up, both women, and they said, "We'd like to see Mission Impossible." They opened up their iPhones and they started clicking around, and they went to MoviePass, and they couldn't check in to MoviePass to see Mission Impossible Fallout.
That's right. I think the most frustrating thing about MoviePass is that you often have to go to the theater to find out they're not going to let you see a movie. That's what happened to me. I looked online, looked like I could see a movie. I went out to the theater and they're like, "Oh, sorry, can't check in. Why don't you go to one of our theaters where we have a deal?" So it's very frustrating. So as you all well know, MoviePass has closed up shop. The business is gone. It's over. They said, "We tried. We felt like we've changed the industry, but it's all over. MoviePass is dead."
Well,
oh, no, wait. I'm sorry. That's next week's script.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I meant to look. Where's this week's script? All right. I'm sorry. MoviePass is still facing turmoil and uncertainty about its future after a chaotic weekend.
Yes. It's if there.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to jump ahead like that.
This is like MoviePass's lost weekend, because you know, even if they get a huge, let's say they get their $1.2 billion. Okay. Let's say they get that.
I don't even know who loaned them $5 million on Thursday. Who was the idiot that said, "Yeah, we'll give you $5 million"? What could they have possibly offered up as collateral?
Well, I don't know, but I will tell you this. On August 1st, so on Wednesday of this, of next week, mm-hmm. they have to pay $5 million, that $5 million back, and then they have to pay an additional $1.2 million back by August 5th. So I have no idea who lent them $6.2 or $6.6 million to kind of as a bridge loan until August 5th.
Just to get through the weekend,
yeah.
Basically.
And they obviously didn't have enough money because they pretty much turned off the app for most theaters and most movies. I, for some reason, was able to check in everywhere except for Mission Impossible.
You could actually see a movie?
Every movie that was...
You
that
went to the theater and checked in?
I went to the theater. I checked in. It worked. However,
when?
I could not...
What day?
It was Saturday.
Well, yeah, today is the day they shut it down again. Saturday they said, "Oh, our surcharge is now $8 for lots of movies." They just kept raising the surcharge.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because there were some, if you look on Twitter, here in Los Angeles, there was a lot of people complaining that at the Los Feliz 3, this is kind of a small, I don't want to say a discount theater, but it's an indie theater.
They were charging more than the theater charged.
Yes, they were charging $8 surcharge for a $6 ticket. And the number of people
which goes to show their surcharges and their what movies are available and not available have nothing to do with the theater you're at or the cost of the ticket or
correct.
Anything like that.
Or the MoviePass, fact that about whether it's, ideal. What they always said, what's surge pricing was going to be much like Uber. It's going to be an algorithm.
Friday, Saturday night. Yeah.
Right. But it's not. It's basically a policy, meaning there's no variables associated with it. It's only just, here's the policy. You can't see movies Friday and Saturday night.
Well, yeah, it's not surge pricing. They wouldn't let me see anything, even if I was willing to pay $8 extra to do so. So basically, the app has collapsed. The company is collapsing. They've run out of money. They tried to they shut down the app on Thursday. They borrowed $5 million. They said, okay, you can go to movies. They raised the surcharge price Friday and Saturday, but said nobody gets to see Mission Impossible and stop complaining. And then on Sunday, they just shut down everything. They said, you can't see anything. Nobody could go. I couldn't check into any movie at any theater, surcharge price or not. The only thing they kept saying was, well, go to a theater where we have e-ticketing. And that's another way of saying, go to one of those handful of theaters where we have a deal like Landmark and we get discounted tickets. If you can't, if we don't have a deal with the theater, we're not going to let you buy a ticket. So they're obviously down to the bottom of the barrel. This week or next, we're going to hear they've either closed up shop or gotten an infusion of cash. I'm sure it will be the former.
Well, you know, even if they get an infusion of cash, I wonder if their reputation after this weekend, I mean, it's already on shaky ground because everybody thinks it's a deal that's too good to be true. Even their best customers, the customers that love them the most are like, this is great and it's going to be great while it lasts and they're never going to survive. You know, like nobody who loves this company thinks it's going to be around next year at this time.
Okay. But I'll still keep using it if it works.
Exactly.
But if they stop and say, you can't see any movies except the four theaters where we have a deal, then I will cancel it. I will definitely cancel it before August 21st if this nonsense keeps up. But if they bring back the service and, you know, whatever, but they won't. It's a business plan that can't work. If you don't have a deal, as we've said from the start, if you don't have a deal with the theaters and the studios, this won't work. The more customers you have, the more money you lose. It's a losing proposition for MoviePass. There's no way to make it work. The only way they thought it would work is if they got so many people, the studios would cave and the theaters would cave and start to cut deals with them. They got 3 million people. They got a lot.
Yeah, but I wonder how many of them do they still have after all of the surge
I don't know
pricing.
Anyone who has canceled. Because okay. It's only been 24, 48 hours for
no,
God's
no, no.
sake.
I mean, once the surge pricing kicked in a couple weeks ago and once you could only see a movie once and like...
I don't know. Everybody I know says, I'm not ready to give it up. I hope it lasts.
Okay.
They're like, you can complain all you want, but it's still the best deal in town.
So what
if
you're saying is...
If they're giving away Lamborghinis for $50, I'm willing to wait in line.
Okay. So what you're saying is that effectively, even though membership and subscription services, they have a churn, right? The churn isn't so high yet that they have to start reporting it.
They're not going to report anything. They're going out of business.
Well, they'll have to report that to the SEC.
Yeah, they're closing. They're going out of business. That is, it's just a matter of days. They ran out of money. They have no. Who's going to loan them more money? The company is going out of business. People are all writing their obituary. It'll probably be announced by the time this podcast is out. And the only question is MoviePass the future? You linked me to a story in Vox talking about all the things we've talked about before that, hey, it demonstrates there is an audience for this. Is it the future of all movie going? No, because most people don't want to see three or four movies or five movies a month. Most people don't go to the movies that much. But for hardcore moviegoers, there's a real demand for this, and it might make sense for studios and theaters to get together and say, let's encourage our most passionate customers to go to lots of movies, bump up the opening weekend, talk up the films that they like, and that will help drive business and sell more concessions. I think there's a room for it. I just wish it wasn't linked to certain chains. AMC offers $20 a month. Maybe I'll do that, but I sure wish it was industry-wide.
Yeah, I mean, because if you don't live near a good AMC or two or three, then what's the point?
Well, of course you wouldn't do it there, but I really, it's not AMC. They have, you know, of course, big multiplexes have documentary films and smaller art films, but by and large, there's a lot more theaters in New York I like to go to than AMC. So MoviePass is a great deal when I can go to IFC and Metrograph and Angelica and AMC. When all I can go to is AMC and it's twice as much, I'm going to be wary before I do it. But I looked back. I've been a member since November. I've paid $80 in fees. I've had 8 months of MoviePass. I've gone to 41 movies. I've gone to an average of 5 movies a month for the past 8 months. That's a hell of a lot more movies than I would have gone to otherwise. And I talked them up and talked to other people and bought more concessions than I would. It's a lot. I paid $2 a movie. So, you know, that's why MoviePass is such a good deal. Do the studios want me to see movies for $2 a film? Maybe. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe it works. For the 5 million people who are that passionate, maybe it's smart to give them a good discount and get them going all the time. Plus, if you just said, hey, no Friday or Saturday night, I'd be fine. You know, that's a good deal for the theaters and the studios because it gets people going Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Well, not Thursday necessarily. That's a big opening night. It's not a good deal for MoviePass. They don't benefit by shunting you to Tuesday because the tickets are usually the same price in big cities. So while it was great for the theaters that MoviePass encouraged people to go on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that didn't save MoviePass a penny. Because if I go on Monday night in New York City, I'm still spending $15 for my ticket. So they didn't benefit. It would benefit theaters to encourage passionate moviegoers to go on weekdays and off hours. And they could do that because they know what times are in demand.
Well, you know, I finally figured out why I'm not seeing surge pricing at all. I never see surge pricing. I mean, and you know, I've wanted to because I want to write a story for Celluloid Junkie about how surge pricing doesn't necessarily tie into the fact that anybody's in the theater when the show showing
not.
Starts.
Yeah,
right?
They have no information on that, so it couldn't.
Right, and so I couldn't do it because I could never get surge pricing, and I could never actually. In any case, it's because I purchased my MoviePass subscription through Costco, a kind of a big retailer here in the U.S. And it was $80 for the whole year. Plus I got, you know, a subscription to Fandor. So they don't have my credit card information. Costco does.
And so they never ask you to put in a credit card info?
No, not at all. And, you know, they did ask me to take tickets of my ticket stub, or sorry, pictures of my ticket stubs and send them in, which I did. And you know, but they don't have I'm a yearly subscriber, so they would be changing the terms of service in the middle of my subscription.
So unlike me, you're going to have to eat the rest of your money because I'm only paying by the month.
Correct. I would probably, if they go out of business, you're assuming they're going out of business. Well, if and when they go out of business, I will have to eat the rest of my money, which is why we need to wrap this up now so I can go to the movies.
When does your subscription end?
November.
Oh, so you've got quite a few months left. So you've only, yeah. So, and, well, no, wait. Yeah. So do you know how many movies you went to? You can check it on your app.
I'm pretty sure. Oh no, I'll go and check it while
you can. You can add it up. And let me ask you this: do you think there will be a sequel to MoviePass? We know AMC has done it. Will there be an industry-wide sequel, or is that just not going to happen because too many different companies would have to work together?
I think too many different companies would have to work together right now. Cinemia here in the U.S. is trying to do it, so I think that actually,
but their plan stinks. Their plan is a joke.
Yeah, it's not very good right now. I have not seen as many movies as I thought I did. It seems like I should have seen more. One, two, three, four. Wow. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I did not see enough movies. I've got to go right now. I've got to start seeing more movies.
Well, there may be a sequel to MoviePass. Certainly AMC already has one. And there may be a sequel to Frasier. Reboots and sequels and spinoffs. This baby is back. Frasier, they're talking about rebooting Frasier in some way, shape, or form. Kelsey Grammer's like, I'm ready. David Hyper says, I'm available. And Charlie's Angels, they're going to make a new Charlie's Angels movie. I think it's going to be a tad more serious, not as jokey as the last one. And it's going to star Kristen Stewart. And Elizabeth Banks is going to co-write, direct, and play Bosley.
That makes sense, the last part that you said about Elizabeth Banks. That, I think, will work.
There you go.
Now, you know, just a follow-up on those two women who came to see Mission Impossible with MoviePass. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know what they did when they couldn't get in with MoviePass to see Mission Impossible? They actually, they didn't go to the movies. They left.
Well, that's the same thing. I went to the movie theater and I left too.
Yeah, and I watched two or three other people do that. And then I finally went up to the guy at the box office and said, look, I know the Mission Impossible MoviePass thing. Well, how many people just leave? And he said probably a good 7 out of 10 people go, yeah, okay, I don't want to see, you know.
Oh, well, I wouldn't pay for a ticket if I already felt like I had. Yeah, of course not.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've done this before. In New York, I've been asking at box office, 30-40% of people on opening weekend are MoviePass people. You know, in big cities, a lot of people have MoviePass. In the Heartland, not so much.
Yeah, that's what they really needed, was the people in the Heartland to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then after they went to the movies to go to an amusement park.
Yeah, that's
China,
right.
In China.
That's right. We talked about amusement parks. In the Middle Kingdom, most theme parks lose money, but that doesn't mean the good ones can't flourish. A new one just opened up. It's called HB World. It's in the Jiangsu province, and that's where Detective D3 opened up its world premiere. It was at a theme park in China. And there's another theme park on the books. It's a Nickelodeon theme park. It's going to be inside the Mall of China. clearly modeled after the Mall of America. It must be really, really big if they can squeeze in a theme park. But Nickelodeon is going to have their first indoor theme park in China. The deal has been signed, so that will come up down the road.
Now, this is a joke. Okay, I'm prefacing this lest people think that I'm actually being serious here. But you know how everybody says, oh my goodness, the Chinese are always stealing intellectual property. The Chinese, you know, government or the Chinese companies are always stealing intellectual property. Now they're stealing mall concepts.
Okay.
Mall of America, Mall of China. Oh, come on.
That's okay.
Oh, brother. All right. Well, then maybe we should talk about, I don't know, what you're reading this week, Michael.
That's right. It's time for Book Filter. And we got two books on our menu, two books that studios might want to option or somebody option. One of them is a memoir. It's called Okay, Fine, Whatever. It's by Courtney Haymeister. I guess that's how one's Hamister, Haymeister. I'm not sure how to say
Hamister.
Her name, but Hamister, how would you know?
I said it with such authority and conviction that it must have been true.
That's right. She's a woman in her 40s, and she worked on radio and other. She's a media person, and she's been nervous her entire life. She says, "I'm a nervous Nelly," and she finally decided enough. And she said, "I'm going to force myself to do all the things that scare me." And so she got high legally, which apparently she never did before. She paid for a session with a professional cuddler. That would sure scare the hell out of me, I must say. She went into a sensory deprivation tank. She attended a fellatio class. And in perhaps an unrelated item, she went on 28 first dates. So
is this a nonfiction book?
This is a memoir by Courtney Hamister.
Wow.
That's awesome. I think that's very fun. And I could see, you know, Reese Witherspoon is someone else saying, I'm a timid person and I want to remake my life. It sounds like a fun thing for me. Somebody daring themselves to do the things that have always scared them. And in between it all, you know, 28 first dates peppered in among all that, that would be fun. I think that's a property ripe for development. But I'm not always right. I thought IQ by Joe Ide was a terrific property. Great reviews. The sequel has come out. Great reviews for that. They've both done well. It's about a Japanese-American spin on E.Z. Rollins and Sherlock Holmes. It's a kid in L.A. who is whip smart, just like Sherlock Holmes. And like E.Z. Rollins, he is just as likely to take a case helping kids deal with a bully as he is to take one involving a famous rap star. He takes cases large and small. It's a really engaging book. Terrific first novel. It's come out now in mass paperback. I talked about it when it came out in hardcover. It proved a big success on every level. And as far as I can tell, it hasn't been optioned yet. And that just puzzles me. When you watch Crazy Rich Asians, and I've heard that movie is really fun, really sexy, going to be a big success at the box office. That's going to open up people's eyes to, we've got a big demographic here that is underserved, the Asian American contingent. We've got Koreans, we've got Japanese, we've got Filipinos, we've got people from all over the world, and they all have diverse tastes and cultures. But you know what? Make movies with Asian characters in them, and they will respond, and IQ needs to be picked up.
Well, you don't know that it hasn't. Very often what you'll find is that these movies are optioned, or sorry, these books are optioned, and they're optioned for very little money. They don't make a big splash. They don't get picked up in the trades. You know, the option doesn't get picked up in the trades. And, you know, they either are optioned for years on end with nothing ever happening to them. They're developed or not developed. How to Make an American Quilt, for instance. That was never something that anybody knew about. You know, it was my Old Man and the Sea, a book that, you know, was a great book about a father and son sailing around, Cape Horn? They sailed around South America, the tip of South America. And it was picked up by Spielberg and, you know, you never heard about it again, and it was never made into a movie. And, you know, you just, there's too many properties.
No, I know. I might not have heard about it, but
How to Make an American Quilt was made. Yes, eventually. Yes.
Yeah. And IQ by Joe Ide was not a small under the radar book. Huge buzz for this book from the very start. So I think we would have heard if it was a property. I think it would have made news, but it's very possible that it has been optioned and I just don't know about it. That's true. But given the profile of this book from the very beginning and the huge success it had as a novel and the sequel coming out, I think we would have heard in the midst of the sequel, they would have said, and the original has already been optioned, you know, is being made by a film by, you know, blah, blah, blah productions. That's the sort of thing you would mention when you were promoting the sequel to the book. It's, you know, people are like, oh, they're making a movie out of it. Maybe I'll read it. So the fact that that wasn't mentioned makes me think it probably was an option. But you're absolutely right. I just might have missed it.
Now, IQ, when it was initially released in, when was it released? Last year, right?
A year and a half ago, something like that.
Was it on one of your top picks over on bookfilter.com?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, when we mentioned it on the show.
Yeah, okay. Just wondering. I mean, you know, my memory, I'm getting older. My memory isn't always as good as it used to be.
Yeah, IQ came out in hardcover October 18th, 2016.
Wow.
Then it came out in trade paperback, and now it comes out in mass market paperback. More and more, you see books coming out in every format all at once, or not coming out in hardcover at all. There makes no sense in waiting for a paperback edition when you come out with an ebook edition. It's true, the ebook edition might be $10, but when it's available right away at the same time as the hardcover, why the heck are you waiting on the paperback? Why are you making somebody wait a year and a half before you give them the $8 mass market edition?
Previously, that was the classic example that was always used in business school for product managers of product versioning, where you have a version of a product that it sells at one price and the same exact product, just changed a little bit, selling at a lower price, but available much later. But that brings us to our sexual misconduct news for the week. And I feel like, do we still have this news? But apparently, we do still have this news. And it is, this week, a bombshell, although I have to say, and I think I may have told you this in the past, you know, when we haven't been recording, I'm wondering when Les Moonves is going to, you know, somebody's going to point their finger at Les Moonves. Not because he was, you know, is a known, you know, sexual harasser, or everybody in Hollywood is talking about him as being...
Well, if you know he is, how else
than
he
is? For me, it was a matter of, I kind of went down my mental list of, okay, who is high enough on the chain that is somebody's going to turn around and point a finger at them?
Oh my God, don't say that. No, you're saying because he's powerful, someone's falsely accusing him. That's ridiculous. Just because he's well-known and powerful doesn't mean he's inevitably going to get accused of sex. He's accused of misconduct and assault because he assaulted and sexually harassed people.
Allegedly.
Not allegedly. He has been accused of that. Don't say because he's powerful, therefore it's only a matter of time before he gets accused. That's BS. Most people are not accused of sexual harassment and assault or rape. Most producers in Hollywood, most directors, most studio executives are not accused of it. The people who are accused of it are not automatically guilty, but it doesn't just happen because you're famous and powerful. That's ridiculous. Most people are never accused of that because they don't do it.
Well,
he is accused of it because 6 women have come forward and said on the record, he assaulted me, he harassed me, he asked for sex, and when I didn't give it to him, my career was hurt by it. Dozens of people have come forward to talk about the culture of harassment that is present in CBS throughout the entire network, including 60 Minutes, which multiple people have talked about. Les Moonves has actress Ileana Douglas saying, this bastard assaulted me. And you're saying, well, yeah, he's a famous person. Eventually, someone's going to accuse him.
No, what I was saying
is, it does not happen to famous people. It happens to famous people who assault people. That's who it's happening to.
I started saying something, but I wasn't allowed to finish. What I was going to say in finishing is that because of the lawsuit that is now occurring with Sherry Redstone and Viacom and the whole re-merger of Viacom.
That has nothing to do with it. That has nothing to do with it. Ileana Douglas is not accusing him because there's a power struggle at Viacom over CBS. That is not why this is happening. This is happening because brave people came forward and people are starting to pay a price for the horrible, terrible things that they have done. Harvey Weinstein raped people. Kevin Spacey raped people. And now they are finally facing the news for the horrible things they have done. There are 6 women have come forward about Les Moonves personally. They are not all lying. Some of these accusations go back decades.
They all go back decades, if you notice.
No. Oh, I'm sorry. He hasn't done it recently. Maybe he hasn't done it since he married Julie Chen.
Yeah, they all go back to the 90s and the aughts. And what?
They go all the way back to the aughts? Wow.
No, well, you know what I'm saying? I'm reporting what was reported. You know, I'm going back to what was reported.
This is not coming forward because of Viacom and a power struggle. It's coming forward because for several years now, people who have been brave enough to come forward have found, guess what? You were assaulted or harassed by someone, you weren't alone. And when one person steps forward, other people step forward because they have the same damn story to tell. That's why this is happening. Not a power struggle at Viacom, not simply because he's powerful, because most executives do not get accused of harassment or assault.
Well, I don't think that, I don't know that necessarily legally. I don't know that, you know, in the case of the CBS issue.
They're civil. She could file civil suits, I'm sure, but it's all happened long ago, one voice against another.
Yeah,
this guy's not keeping his job. There's no way.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I just can't see him keeping his job. Although, speaking of people who did not keep their job and then were reinstated, Chris Hardwick, you might recall, we talked about his I guess, being...
You know, every case is different. If a dozen women came forward, Chris Hardwick would not have his job. If six women came forward, he would not have his job. It doesn't mean the accusation against him wasn't founded in fact. We can't know that much, but we feel a lot more comfortable saying, wow, six people came forward, all telling similar stories. That guy's going down. Chris Hardwick doesn't mean one person standing alone isn't telling the truth, but, you know, it's private life. They had a relationship. Studios cannot investigate every personal matter and find out whether there's a criminality or something that goes beyond the pale. All they can really control is what happens on the set of their shows and if something goes to court. So, you know, every case is different. In this case, they said, well, we don't have any ill reports yet from the shows he works on. You know, from what we know, they said, and they were careful to say, you know, based on what we have access to and information, you know, he's going to come back to work. Doesn't mean he's a wonderful guy. It doesn't mean anything. It just means, you know, nothing rose to a level where they can or should take action. At least that's their judgment right now.
Right. And they did an investigation and they didn't do it. They had an outside group do it.
Right. And CBS is doing an investigation. The board is going to meet on Monday. They're going to discuss his fate and an investigation. And Sherry Redstone spoke up. She said the investigation should be thorough and transparent and then he should be fired. Well, that was
yeah. See what I mean? Because he needs to go true. so that I can do what I want to do with the company.
Talk to how much trouble there is. 41% of women in media jobs report sexual harassment. That's just one survey, but it is the highest of any white collar job. If you're a white collar worker, you think, "Oh, I'm in a world. I'm not working in construction where men are going to slap me on the ass, and maybe I have to take it," which you don't. But I'm in white collar jobs. I'm going to be less likely to have to suffer anything like that. And it happens, and it's worse in media than anywhere else. There goes the idea that we're liberal and, you know, we're progressive and positive.
Well, certainly. Look, I mean, obviously, yes, Chris Hardwick coming back. You know, it was big news when he was kind of when the accusations were made and he was asked not to attend Comic-Con and he dropped out of Comic-Con and he was kind of kicked off his show there, The Talking Dead. It's bigger news this week about Les Moonves because, you know, he has been instrumental to the success of CBS. I'm not saying that means he should be able to do anything he wants. I'm saying that there is a network and people's jobs on the line here. He was able to...
He made him a lot of money, which is why he presumably got away with stuff that he shouldn't have. Kareem, but you know, James Gunn was kicked off Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Maybe that happened too fast. We have a link to a big athlete, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who has great pieces in Hollywood Reporter, and he talks about how Hollywood's new zero tolerance policy on offensive speech makes zero sense. He's always thoughtful, always interesting. It's worth checking out. But he's a big talent in sports, and now he's a big talent in writing. I really think, you know, he's got a new book coming out, a Shakespeare and Moriarty book. You know, he's really a big deal when it comes to writing in general.
Well, I liked the way you had mentioned the word big twice, and I think that kind of, you know, a buzzer went off, and you went, oh, big deal, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. Well, you know, you think CBS blew it. ABC blew it. They had a new signature show with the acclaimed sitcom Black-ish and a talented creator with the ideas, you know, he had ideas for more comedies and dramas. He wanted to deliver them to ABC, but Kenya Barris only heard the word no from ABC, which surely had first crack at dramas and comedies that would be developed by other outlets. When they finally said yes to a spinoff from Black-ish, They placed the show on ABC Family rather than the network itself, much less pairing it with Black-ish the way, say, The Cosby Show was paired with A Different World. As if that wasn't bad enough, ABC gave Barish grief over the political content of his show, simply refusing to air one episode of Black-ish last season. Assuming the episode didn't end with a chant of a line from NWA, how could they possibly not accommodate one of their biggest and brightest talents? Instead, exactly. Barish is walking away from ABC. Get this, he's walking away 1 year into a four-year deal, accepting a deal with Netflix valued at nine figures. And that's, hold on, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's a lot of money. That's like more than $100 million if you don't want to do the math. Wait, I just did. Ugh, I should read these before I read them. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, and they made a big noise and said it's a nine-figure deal. Netflix lured him with a lot of money. This isn't about the money. This is about respect and them not making full use of this talented artist who delivered them a big hit and wanted to do more, and they just blocked him every step of the way and messed with his baby, the Black-ish. It was ridiculous what they did, and they're paying the price, and they deserve to.
The union that represents most of the crew members on movie and TV sets reached a new three-year agreement with TV producers. Officially, IATSE and the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers are the groups that signed a deal, but somehow say they're just punting on the most contentious issue. Union members say producers are starving their pension plan by refusing to include residuals from streaming services like Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime. This deal simply ignores that issue, and as a result, at least one local is urging union members to vote against it. That's probably because those streaming things are totally not the future. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I don't get it why they're doing it. And this is why SAG-AFTRA is going on strike. The deal that they've got is not nearly as good as the deal that was gained by the WGA, the DGA, or SAG-AFTRA. The SAG-AFTRA is going to strike on TV voice actors. We talked about that last week.
Right.
The issue sort of addressed, but really poorly. There's a minor charge. And in fact, that's probably going to penalize smaller companies more than big companies. It really won't be a burden to them. So it's actually going to hurt the little guy. And there's no additional hourly pension contribution. So it just really doesn't make any sense. I don't know why they didn't push harder. They should be striking if they can't strike a good deal. And every time you say IATSE, I think you've rolled the dice and hit five sixes. I feel like Yahtzee. Every time you say that, I want to go Yahtzee.
Yeah, well, you know, look, there's that old saying, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And I think, you know, the DVD thing where the studios and the distributors turned to all of these unions and said, look, we cannot pay you DVD residuals because this is a new emerging technology. We have no idea how much money it's going to make. And by not knowing how much money it's going to make, we think it's going to make billions and we don't want to pay you. they basically, you know, the jig was up. Everybody knew that that was the case moving forward, so they couldn't try it. They couldn't.
I hope the IATSE members hold their bosses to a higher standard and say, no, this is not acceptable.
Is slow ticketing the quickest way to higher grosses? To me, when I read that, I thought, what the heck does that even mean? And that's the feeling, the slow ticketing thing, that's the feeling in the music business. Slow ticketing has caught on with big acts. They slap a very high price on seats and then don't discount them as the show date gets closer and closer. In fact, artists like Taylor Swift don't mind if the show isn't sold out anymore. Premium tickets available right up to showtime keep scalpers out of the game. And slow ticketing keeps any profits in-house rather than flowing to scalpers who profit from the business but don't invest in it. Acts used to be delighted by sellouts. Now more and more, they're perfectly happy with record high grosses. Big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. It is a sort of a sea change in what touring acts are doing, and that's where you're making your money because you're not making it on CD sales or on royalties from Spotify, not unless you're really, really big. So, you know, it's a tough call. I hate to see such high prices. I hate to see tickets unavailable for average fans, and they just keep saying, you know what, better us than the scalpers.
Right, and before it used to be. It was the quote unquote scalpers. And the reason that I put air quotes around the word scalpers is because
it was sometimes them selling it on the secondary market. Yeah.
Right, exactly. They were basically saying, well, we don't want to look greedy. So we'll sell it, on the secondary market, but, under a pseudonym, or we'll give it to the touts and they'll do it for us and cut us in on the action. And now everybody seems to know, yeah, that's what was happening. So they might as well just go and sell it themselves at a high price.
And maybe this is another piece of the puzzle, along with Verified Fan and other ways to make sure that people aren't reselling their tickets. You know, if you can keep them low priced and let people who have the tickets keep the tickets and not be able to resell them, and you have premium tickets available for people who want to pay a ton of money, you know, maybe there's a happy balance to be made. But you don't want to forget, most people can't afford anywhere near that, and you don't want to scare them off from the habit of going to concerts.
Good point. Just like you don't want to scare them off from the habit of seeing movies for $9.95 a month, unlimited. Nicole Kidman has snagged the rights to the next novel by the author of Big Little Lies. Of course, Kidman and Reese Witherspoon starred in and produced that previous Emmy-winning project, so it's no surprise Kidman had the inside track on Leanne Moriarty's latest, which is called Nine Perfect Strangers. It's about nine strangers who head to a health spa for a 10-day retreat. Movie? TV miniseries? No one knows yet, but Kidman does know she's going to star in it. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal. Where the heck is Reese Witherspoon? She's optioning things left and right. I'm like, how did she not get in on this deal?
Well, she still may.
Maybe she will. Yeah, Nicole's like, I might have a part for you.
I'll throw you
a bone. Maybe she's too busy with her streaming, her cable channel, which really made no sense to me at all.
What is that? Happy Sunshine or whatever? Yeah, something.
Exactly. Can't remember. She's a smart woman. Smart woman, option, lots of good stuff, making projects happen. But that one didn't click with me.
And I don't know why she's just not calling it Reese TV. Jeffrey Katzenberg has a tremendous track record. That's all I need to say. That's the big deal or big what. No,
it's true.
He was a key player in the rebirth of Disney animation. Then he built up a successful animation studio from scratch at DreamWorks. Shrek, anyone? Now investors clearly believe Katzenberg will be at it again. They've invested, a small sum of $1 billion in his latest venture. And by they, we mean heavyweights like Fox, Disney, Warner Brothers, Entertainment One, and the like. Those companies invested about $200 million each, and it was just $200 million. Institutional investors came in and coughed up the other $800 million. And what exactly are they investing in? It's called New TV. Katzenberg believes a huge market will develop for short-form, high-quality entertainment. Imagine comedies and dramas offered up in brief bursts of a few minutes to 5 minutes or even up to 15 minutes, but no more. They'll be just as high in production value and cost as top shows on networks and cable. Expect $5 million to $6 million an hour, maybe? People will watch on their phones or tablets here and there and everywhere. The platform will be, who knows? The talent involved? Yeah, they're not signed yet. But the CEO is Meg Whitman, formerly of Hewlett-Packard, and they've certainly got a big kitty of money. I wonder if they're looking for a two-hour podcast. Big deal or big what?
What the heck is this? I don't get it. If it's a platform, well, it seems like I get the idea. I could see a daily, 5 day a week soap opera that lasts 10 minutes that people would just consume, on the way to work or home or whatever, or just in a brief burst. That makes perfect sense to me that could become a thing. But it could be hosted on Twitter and YouTube and Facebook or a million other platforms. So I don't see the need for a new platform. If it's the content that they're developing, why is Meg Whitman in charge? What the heck does she know about creative stuff? Nothing. So it doesn't make any sense to me on any level, and they've given him $1 billion. Smart guy, but I just don't get this at all.
Meg Whitman.
Do you?
No.
Do you?
No, I do not.
It's like, if it could work, but why do they need to give him $1 billion? For what? Is he signing somebody to create a show? Is this to budget a show? Does he think there has to be a new platform?
He's a very good salesperson.
Ugh. Yeah, I wish he'd sell our burgers. All right.
You've heard of Hamilton, the Broadway musical. Get ready for Hamilton, the movie. And guess what? Guess what? Unlike, that last story where nothing is made and nothing is done and nobody's signed and there's no script and no platform and no business, They've already shot it. They've already shot this movie. Yeah, this isn't a full-blown feature film. This is a taping of one of the final performances of the Broadway production with the original cast. Normally, that sort of thing would air on PBS or one night only in movie theaters. But this is Hamilton, and all bets are off. They're now accepting offers from studios, and the expectation, at least from the Hamilton folk, is that the price tag could be in the tens of millions, right up to $50 million, in fact. Why not? Of course, none of this precludes making an actual movie of Hamilton somewhere down the line. I mean, they're not throwing away their shot, after all. But one thing is ruled out. The live performance won't hit movie screens until 2020 at the earliest. There's a reason for that. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. They filmed it. I'm sure it will be more valuable than any other one of these things done ever before. Whether they can sell it for 10 or 20 million, I don't know. Will they make that much money on it at the theaters? I don't know. But it might be a gamble worth making. And since they can already look at the what they captured on film, it's probably really exciting. So, you know, this is just the biggest one of these things that we've ever seen. And it probably makes more sense to do just a one night only screening. Why not have a theatrical run for it? Can't hurt. And at this stage, I don't think it will hurt the show. You know, you've waited a few years. The show has run a while. I think we've seen enough that, especially when it's just capturing a certain performance, I think it will just send people back to the cast album or wanting to see the show again.
Yeah. And if it's in movie theaters, people will want to be in the room where it's projected.
Exactly. But, you know, Chicago, they always worried if you made a movie that would kill the show. We've got plenty of examples now where that hasn't happened. They made a horrible Phantom of the Opera. It didn't hurt the show. They made a successful, not a very good, but a successful version of Chicago. That hasn't hurt the show at all. It even powered the show up higher. So, you know, there's no rule anymore. And Hamilton has thrown the rule book out anyway.
Why would hurt a show when shows are from movies?
Well, because if you can see the show, then you feel like you don't have to pay extra to see it again. And if you know, you've seen the show in its best possible light, why would you want to pay to see it again?
Yeah.
But let me read the next piece, because I think your response is more interesting than mine. Technicolor is going out of business.
What?
Apparently, along with MoviePass. No, not the business of color grading film stock, or should we say digital stock at this stage, and they're still involved in special effects. But Technicolor is shutting down its feature film sound unit and restructuring the rest of its business. They're still in the game of sound when it comes to TV. Thanks to Netflix and the like, there's enough demand to keep the lights on in that area. But color grading and visual effects are their bread and butter, including upcoming special effects projects like the live-action versions of Dumbo and The Lion King. Oh, by the way, I saw the trailer for Dumbo, and it looked great.
I know.
I don't even like the animated version. I thought, wow, that's a good trailer. I mean, Tim Burton, his movies are not usually that good. They always look better in preview than they are, but that was a good trailer. So Technicolor is getting out of the feature film sound unit business. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? And I don't know, so that's why I'm asking you.
Well, a couple things. So, you know, it used to be that color grading, you could pick, I don't know, you want more red, you want more blue, or you want more green. And you have to, like, apply it to the entire image. There was none of this, well, I want more red, but I only want it on that bush. And then the house, I want to make a little bit more green, and I want to make it look more like a sunset. And as far as the right side of the screen, give me some more blue. You know, there was none of that, okay? Now, okay, with digital imaging and digital intermediates, you can actually isolate specific, you know, sections of the screen or
it's a much more sophisticated art.
You could say, I'm circling this guy's face. It's in shadow. I need it to come out of shadow. And I need you to track that face throughout the shot. And as you track that face throughout the shot, it needs to, that lighting needs to stay that way.
It's far more sophisticated, okay?
And that is what Technicolor has always been good at. And in the digital world, they're even better at it. Of course, there are, you know, anybody with a base light, which is what these, you know, the software and the machines are called, seems to think they're good at it. What they have a particular advantage at is they have all the good colorists. They hired, you know, the best colorists in the business. People will wait and wait to get that colorist at Technicolor. And there are colorists in other places. They did the same thing with sound and audio.
Yeah, they have 10-time Oscar nominated mixers. They have multiple Oscar winning mixers, you know, on their staff who are going to be out of work at the end of the year. So what's the deal with sound? Why are they leaving that business? They've got some of the best talent working for them.
Well, because it's just not profitable. It's not what they're known for. It's resource heavy. You can't just have, you know, if you're mixing, you need to, you know, you could be there for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks mixing a film.
Color grading doesn't take a long time too.
It does, but in a different way. You know, you could do that with the cinematographer, bring the director in later. Skywalker Sound. There are companies that specialize in doing audio. And that
so when, where, did they enter this, when did they enter this business of the sound?
You know, I'm trying to remember whether they bought Tadeo or Deluxe bought Tadeo. You know, they basically bought their way into it, if I'm not mistaken. And now they're basically saying, okay, that business has run its course. And we're no longer really doing.
So they went out of their comfort zone and they shouldn't have done that.
I think so. I think that, you know, certainly they've always done some form of audio, but not the audio mixing and you know.
And what I never would have thought of Technicolor as being involved in special effects. In what way are they involved in special effects? They don't create them like ILM or something or Weta.
No. Or do they? But no, not like that. But when you have all of these effects coming in from all, and you've seen the ends of these movies where the credits go on for about 9 days, and you've got 50 different visual effects companies all working at the same time on different parts of the film, or even the same parts, they're working on different characters and they all have to get blended together. Well, that's where they're working on special effects. They're taking opticals and they're putting them together, and they're taking all the effects and making sure it looks like one film.
Well, they did a good job on the trailer of Dumbo. I'll give them that.
But you know, I guess right now the big problem is for Technicolor to shut down their audio business. There are films in the pipeline that they've committed to work on that are going to be out through the end of the year.
Well, they said they're gonna be staying, keep the lights on. Their employees have jobs till the end of the year, but then they're gonna be looking around.
Okay. Well, somebody who is no longer around is gonna be working on the next Star Wars film, Carrie Fisher.
Well, I don't know if that counts as a special effect, but yeah, they at one point said, well, we're just gonna, you know, respect the wishes, but the family said, no, it's fine. You know, we've got footage of her. If you can work her, I mean, she died in the film, so I'm not sure what's gonna happen in the next movie, but they're gonna have some footage of her. So,
did she die,
you
know, in I'm the sure, film? Did she die? I know that Mark Hamill died. The Luke Skywalker.
No, oh, that's right. They killed him off and not her. That's right. Whoops.
By the way, spoiler alert.
Yeah. No, it's so that's not good. Yeah, they made the wrong call there. Very unfortunate. Of course, it's sad that Carrie Fisher died. You know, very funny person, a great talent, especially as a writer. And, you know, they've got footage of her. They can use her in the film and gracefully give her a way out. Why not? You know, it doesn't seem tacky or disrespectful. I'm sure they're going to do it nicely. And they're not going to have her be, I assume, throughout the whole film. But whatever they do, I'm sure it'll be well done.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
I just thought this was interesting, the volatility of stocks. You know, we've got, if we look at the volatility in entertainment stocks and what causes it, is CBS really worth $1.4 billion less if Les Moonves steps down?
Yeah,
is
you know Facebook what? I think possibly, yes.
And is Facebook really suddenly $120 billion less valuable because growth slowed? Is Spotify worth more even as losses continue to mount? So let's look at them. So CBS and Les Moonves, this is my basic question. Yes, it lost $1.4 billion in stock because the man at the helm for decades now may be out. And you're like saying, yeah, you know what? He's been a big reason why CBS has been a big success, and you think that makes perfect sense.
Well, I think, yes, that's really what I'm saying. It's not just that, by the way. It's not just, oh, well, Les Moonves is gone, and you know everybody's replaceable. Everybody thought, oh, my goodness, without Michael Eisner, Disney's not going to be the same, and then along
now
comes...
Now they can't replace their current boss.
Right, and you know what? I'm sure they will. Hopefully, they'll find somebody, but I think we've all proven that people are not indispensable. Certainly, look, Steve Jobs was one of a kind, and you know, Apple has never been the same since he departed, in my opinion.
It has been with profits, though.
Yes, correct. And that for that, you cannot fault the company as far as its innovations. That's another story.
Right, but so then why is CBS stock falling?
I think a part of it is not only Les Moonves of it all. I think the other part is they look at CBS and they say, well, with Les Moonves out of the way, he was the only thing that was stopping Sherry Redstone from just coming in and saying, this is what I'm doing. Viacom, you know, that cancer over there that owns Paramount, we're coming in and we're going to remerge CBS and Viacom together. And CBS, even though you're the cash cow and you're the one that's making all the profits, now you're going to have to support this dead weight over here called Viacom and Paramount. So anyway, thanks a lot.
All right. Well, let's not forget investors thought CBS would suffer when they split. So, you know, it turned out CBS flourished. Now everybody's saying CBS is going to suffer if they get back together again. Maybe they're wrong again.
Right. And then there's the people who are kind of, they're hedging. They're saying, you know, they're taking some profit. They're seeing, you know, they have certain put deals where the stock reaches a certain point and it's an automatic sell, and that causes the stock to go even lower. And so it's market valuation, right? This isn't necessarily worth. Okay, it's just what it's worth at that moment in time.
So now what is Spotify worth? You know, Spotify announced operating losses were up and net losses nearly doubled. What happened? Their stock went up. You know, they hit 83 million premium subscribers. Those are people who pay like $9 or $10 a month, people like me. And they've started to sign up artists, even though they insist, no, 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 that doesn't make us a record label. They've got 180 million people who are on the freemium level, meaning they don't pay, but they hear ads. And even though Spotify continues to lose money and losses mount, and every new person that joins to listen for free costs them more money than they make, Spotify is, you know, their stock is going up.
Yeah, so I mean, I think a lot of people felt like, okay, you have 60 million listeners, you know, premium subscribers. Let's face it, now that Apple's in the game, your growth is going to like totally hit a speed bump. You're never going to be able to hit 80 million. Oh, you did hit 80 million. Okay, actually, that's kind of impressive because Apple Music should be eating your lunch and they have 40 million subscribers, so you should have not been growing as quickly as you are.
Well, there's room for both, right? There's 8 billion people on the planet. Of course, 2 billion of them don't have access to basic water or sanitation, but that's another story.
Well, and Ajit Pai and the FCC is trying to make sure that we don't have, you know, basic, you know, broadband. So,
way to compare no water or sanitation with broadband. My broadband is slow. Wow, first
I just
problem.
Can't win today with my jokes.
No, you can't. So Spotify's going up, and you think that makes sense? Because they're doing better than expectations, or you think it's a good business and they're so big that they're going to be here for the long haul and they'll finally figure out how to make themselves make money off all these people?
I think it's both, really. I think that they are here for the long haul. I think they are the market leader in terms of certainly market awareness. And certainly they do have to start thinking, how are we going to make money? But I think that when it comes to this, it'll come down to a two or three three company race. Right now, it's Amazon and Spotify, and it's nobody else. So, you know, who else are you gonna pick? Pandora? Probably not.
This is a good time to mention that all our stock observations are for entertainment purposes only. Speak to your broker before making any choices.
Oh yeah, definitely do not pick the stock. I actually had the chance to buy Google stock at $84, $85 when it first went on the market.
What is it now?
Oh, like $1,000. It's like ridiculous, and it's split like five times. And you know, I actually asked the person who was offering it to me on its IPO. I said, you know, do you think it could really go up from $85? There's no way. That's so high. And he looked at me and he said, if you can't afford to lose money,
don't
you
play.
Should not
absolutely.
Invest.
Well, that's very good advice. And absolutely, if you can't
sure
afford
enough,
to lose every penny, you shouldn't be buying stocks.
Exactly.
That's absolutely true. So you shouldn't regret it. I know Roger Ebert famously found Google and thought, well, this is awesome. This is great. And he called them up and he said, hey, what do you guys, this is awesome. What are you guys doing? What do you, they're like, he's like, you need anything? You need any help? Need any money? They're like, no, we're cool, but thank you. You know, he's like, no, I love what you're doing. It's great. You know, he was really savvy on digital stuff. He had a great online presence. And, you know, they called him back and they said, hey, you know, actually we could use some money if you want to invest, you know, this is what we'll do. And he wrote them a check for $100,000.
No, it was $10,000.
Was it $10,000? Oh, thank you very much. So it's a famous tech story. Yeah. And that made him very, very wealthy.
Yes. And you know what I love about that story?
What?
Is the number of people who have repeated it back to me. And I was the person who first reported that story. And it was told to me in Cannes by Roger Ebert himself. Just in passing, it was...
You were the first person he ever told it to?
It was myself and Harlan Jacobson.
But he had never mentioned it before in history?
No, it was very early on after they went public. And we were sitting around waiting for Factotum to start, the film Factotum, right before it was down at the Kazan, the director's fortnight. And we had about a half an hour, and he's telling stories, and Harlan Jacobson is telling stories, and I have no stories because they're much older than me, and I didn't have any stories at the time. Just not as good as theirs. And he goes into this Google story. And I then went and wrote it up for Film Stew. Well, I probably should have asked him. He kind of came up to me the next day.
He said, I didn't know I was being interviewed.
Yeah, he said, I know you meant no harm. And it's not a story that makes me look bad. But, you know, you probably should have asked me. If I don't
he's
care,
he's absolutely right. You printed a story that he just is like, I mean, you can do that legally, but certainly not, you know. Ethical.
I thought it was a good story, and the number of people who have reported that back to me.
Well, I heard it from Chaz, so I didn't hear it from him, but Chaz told me that story.
Oh, really? Okay. That's funny. Yeah.
But anyway, moving on to your final topic, Facebook. Facebook has 2.23 billion active monthly users, 2,230,000,000. And they announced for the most recent quarter that revenue was up 42%. Earnings per share grew 32%. Advertising revenue was up 42%. Their revenue was pegged for the quarter at $13 billion. So what happened to their stock? It went down.
Well, okay. So here's a couple things. Did growth slow? We don't know. Okay, we do know this. Here's what we know.
We know all that stuff went up, and analysts expected them to hit 2.35 billion active monthly users, but they only hit 2.33 billion. So they were 20 million active monthly users short of expectations, but they have 2.3 billion monthly users. Maybe it's a mature business. Maybe they're not going to grow anymore with active monthly users. Isn't $2 billion enough? Isn't $13 billion a month revenue okay? It's bizarre to me.
Well, no, what I mean is, remember, this was the whole, Cambridge Analytics thing happened, and you had Mark Zuckerberg going up to the Capitol Hill and testifying before Congress, and then he went to the EU and did a whole thing in, I don't know whether it was the UK's parliament or the EU, but he had to testify in Europe as well about, you know, privacy and whether they're a monopoly, all that hoopla about that, and a whole bunch
their
of people.
Their stock lost 120.
Well, let me finish.
$1 billion in one day.
Yeah, let me finish. So there was some questions. Are people going to delete Facebook? Are people gonna... Now, I don't think they are. Did 20 million people delete Facebook? I don't think they did. Maybe 5 or 10 million people deleted Facebook, and maybe you're still growing at a good rate. And okay, you lost 5 to 10 million people. Well, guess what? That's 5 to 10 million people that were a part of the 20 million people that you thought were going to be a part of your active users.
I think this is all just ridiculous expectations that people always grow by leaps and bounds. You've got 2 billion users, your revenue and ad streams and everything is growing by leaps and bounds, and it's still not enough. Nobody likes a mature business anymore. They're just bored by the idea. If you're not going to, never mind the revenue up by 30%, earnings per share up 30%, revenue up 40%. They made $13 billion, advertising revenue up 42%. I mean, that's a hell of a leap, and still it's not enough. I think it's just crazy.
But how much was their profit for the year or for the quarter? I know revenue was...
I don't know, but I think they're just fine.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly profitable, that's for sure. I think that, you know, there's many things going on here, profit-taking, people trying to get out ahead of any other bad news. The question...
Don't you ever just think investors are overreacting?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. That's all a part of it, right? I mean, that's...
I think entertainment stock is crazy. Entertainment stock used to... Studio stock would go up when a movie opened well, which is just moronic. You know, it's such short-term reaction. It just drives me nuts. But what can you do other than say, hey, it's been a good show?
That's true. Although we do have an email from one of our listeners in Australia, James Gardner. He says, now that the deal and the deal. I mean, let's face it, there's only one deal, right? I mean, oh wait, actually, there's a couple of deals. But in this case,
there's a lot of deals.
Yeah. In this case, James is referring to the deal of Fox Disney, right? I mean, that deal was approved last week by the board of 21st Century Fox. Said, okay, we will be bought by Disney. We, you know, Comcast pulled out. We're more than happy to take the Fox offer. The Disney offer. We'll be acquired by Disney or 20th
it's
Century.
Happening. Yes, it's been approved. Okay, yes, it's approved. Right, we know.
So James is asking, when will it be done? Will it be done before Christmas? He says, I imagine as fast as possible to stop any form of those who are leaving trying to take advantage of leaving. So
what's the question? What's that question there about take advantage of leaving? What does that mean?
I don't know. Actually, I think maybe what he's asking is they are trying to sell the company before people like Stacy Snyder and all of the executives jump ship, trying to go to other jobs, knowing that they are going to not have them necessarily. And then Disney won't have their pick of which executives they want to bring aboard.
I'm sure they've got their pick. They just have to let them know they want them, right?
Right.
It's not easy to find new jobs. I would say looking at AT&T and Time Warner, you could see how that went. It takes a long time for these deals to get approved, and they are not sitting around waiting. They're all ready to jump and get into action as soon as that is approved because they're ready. They've been waiting a year, 6 months, 9 months, 2 years for this to happen. So they've got their plans in place. They're ready to move fast. I'm sure, like James says, it's going to happen very, very quickly because they know exactly what they want to do. And if they don't, they shouldn't have made the deal in the first place.
Well, okay, so it was since December of last year. So they've only been waiting, you know, less than a year.
Yeah. 11 months. Yeah, that's what he's saying. You know, they'll be done by Christmas, I'm sure. Absolutely.
I think that they still have to get past the Brazilian commercial authorities, the EU commercial authorities, and they have to kind of get approved by the regulatory bodies here in the U.S. How fast that can happen, it can probably happen before Christmas in the U.S. Brazil, who knows, the EU can probably happen in line with the U.S.
But I think he's asking about how fast will they act and get rid of what they don't want, be ready to put things into place for their new system, you know, absorb what they want, get rid of the, you know, redundancies, make the efficiencies work and move towards the future. And I think that's what he's talking about. And I think that's going to be very, very fast because they're sitting around waiting for this to happen.
Oh, yeah. I think that the day that it closes, within the first month, you're going to see all of that enacted.
That's right. And they go to Fox Searchlight and say, you've won 10 Oscars. It's not enough.
That's right. We need 12 Oscars. We need more fish love stories.
And we need to find out who has podcast honors so we can be out for them.
That's right. You need to vote for us in wherever they give podcast awards out for. Or at the very least, subscribe to the show in iTunes.
And rate and review. You know you haven't done it, and there's no show next week. Don't forget.
Yes, and I actually, as I'm reading this, I'm launching iTunes just to see if anybody has rated and reviewed us in the last 5 minutes. I do tend to check every, six, 7 minutes, sometimes 10 minutes. iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, you can find us, you can rate and review us. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to our show or contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's how James Gardner got in touch with us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find us on Twitter at showbizsandbox is our handle. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Sandbox is our page, I guess, is what you would refer to it as on Facebook. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's imissmoviepass.com. Just trying to get ahead of the curve. It'll be good in a week or two, if not tomorrow.
You're hoping people misspell MoviePass? Okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage...
No, it's for fans of MoviePass coming together to talk and commiserate. A friend of mine texted me, she said, I'm not ready yet to be gone. I'm not ready. She wants to go to more movies. People are going to be in mourning. I know I am.
You know, the number of Twitter posts I saw that were like, oh man, it was just so good while it lasted. Like, it was already dead. It was like people talking about the dead or the near dead.
Let me go to a movie. They said, no movies. You can't go to a movie. I'm paying $10 a month. And they tell me, I've gone to the theater. I'm like, yeah, go to the theater. Nah, you can't see anything. That's pretty much dead. When they say you can't go to any movie, then it's dead.
Especially when you're a movie-going service. But you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, then please do check out michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.